Okay, and welcome everyone. Another Tuesday afternoon here in America. And I'm sure it's Tuesday night somewhere and Wednesday morning over in Australia, I'm sure. Have to get my readers on, because I am going to continue to read The Scientific Outlook by Bertrand Russell. And I did want to say, first off, before I forget, that all the stations are listener-supported. Shake and Wake, PSN Radio, SoFlo Radio, and EPGN Radio. I caught a little video earlier, I don't even know who it was. I shared it, or maybe it was some kind of a group or something, that told about the amount of wealth that some of the criminal elements, some of the criminal organizations all over the world have, and they talked about the California Crips, and they had so much money, and the California Bloods, and they had so much money, so many billions or hundreds of millions, whatever the case was, and then they spoke about some of the criminal elements of the past, Al Capone, I don't remember some of the other names now, just bunches and bunches and bunches of names. It went on for about 3 minutes, and they told how much money they had amassed. And I made a comment, it's probably going to get flagged or something. I'm sure I'll get a ban for it, but I asked where the Rothschilds and the Rockefeller names were, and what their amount of thievery has amounted to, the hundreds of billions or the trillions or whatever the case is. I didn't see their names anywhere, the Rothschilds or the Rockefellers. I'm assuming that the maker of the video didn't consider those families criminal cartels, but sadly I do. I don't care. I've been in Facebook jail before, and I'll be in there again. I will go back. Let me see. A half paragraph to go over last week's reading, just a little bit. While the particular mechanism of natural selection is no longer regarded by biologists as adequate, the general fact of evolution is now universally admitted among educated people. In regards to animals older than man, the theory of evolution might have been admitted by some people without too great a struggle. But in the popular mind, Darwinism became identified with the hypothesis that man are descended from monkeys. This was painful to our human conceit, almost as painful as the Copernican doctrine that the earth is not the center of the universe. Traditional theology, as is natural, has always been flattered by the human species, has always been flattering to the human species. If it had been invented by monkeys or inhabitants of Venus, it would, no doubt, not have had this quality. As it is, people have always been able to defend their self-esteem under the impression that they were defending religion. Moreover, we know that men have souls, whereas monkeys have none. Interesting. If men developed gradually out of monkeys, at what moment did they acquire a soul? This problem is not really any worse than the problem as to the particular stage at which the fetus acquires a soul. I'm surprised he calls it a fetus and not a parasite or something like that. But new difficulties always seem worse than old ones. since the old ones lose their sting by familiarity. If to escape from the difficulty we decide that monkeys have souls, we shall be driven, step by step, to the view that Protenzoa have souls. And if we are going to deny souls to Protenzoa, we shall, if we are evolutionists, be almost compelled to deny them to men. All these difficulties were at once apparent to the opponents of Darwin, and it is surprising that the opposition to him was not even more fierce than it is, than it was. Darwin's work, even though it may require corrections on many points, nevertheless offers an example of what is essential in scientific method, namely the situation of general laws based on evidence for fairy tales, embodying a fantasy of wish fulfillment. Human beings find it difficult at all spheres to base their opinions upon evidence rather than upon their hopes. When their neighbors are accused of lapse from virtue, people find it almost impossible to wait for the accusation to be verified before believing it. When they embark upon a war, both sides believe that they are sure of victory. When a man puts his money on a horse, he feels sure that it will win. When he contemplates himself, he is convinced that he is a fine fellow who has an immortal soul. The object evidence for each and all these propositions may be the slightest, but our wishes produce an almost irresistible tendency to believe. Scientific method sweeps aside our wishes and endeavors to arrive at opinions in which wishes play no part. There are, of course, practical advantages in the scientific method. If this were not so, it would never have been able to make its way against the world of fantasy. The bookmaker is scientific and grows rich, whereas the ordinary better is unscientific and grows poor. And so, in regard to human excellence, the belief that men have souls has produced a certain technique. For the purpose of improving mankind, which in spite of prolonged and expensive effort has hitherto had no visible good result. The scientific study of life and the human body and mind, on the contrary, is likely, before very long, to give us the power of producing improvements beyond our previous dreams in the health, intelligence, and virtue of average human beings. Maybe he's talking about, what's that called? The people of transhumanism. That's the word I'm looking for. Maybe he's referring to that. Darwin was mistaken, as the laws of heredity, which may have been completely transformed by the Mendelian theory. He had also no theory as to the origin of variations, and he believed them to be much smaller and more gradual than they have been found to be in the certain circumstances. On these points, modern biologists have advanced far beyond him, but they would not have reached the point at which they are but for the impetus given by his work. And the massiveness of his researches was necessary in order to impress men with the importance and inevitability of the theory of evolution. That's the ticket, huh? 4. Pavlov. Each fresh advance in science of science into a new domain has produced a resistance analog in kind to that encountered by Galileo, but growing gradually less in vehemence. Traditionalists have always hoped that somewhere a region would be found to which scientific method would prove inapplicable. After Newton, they abandoned the heavenly bodies in despair. After Darwin, most of them admitted the broad fact of evolution, though they continue to this day to suggest that the course of evolution has not been guided by mechanistic forces, but has been directed by a forward-looking purpose. The tapeworm, we are to suppose, has become what it is, not because it could not otherwise have survived in human intestines, but because it realizes the idea laid up innate in heaven, which is part of the divine mind. As the Bishop of Birmingham says, the loathsome parasite is a result of the integration of mutations. It is both an exquisite example of adaptation to environment and ethically revolting. This controversy is not yet wholly concluded, though there can be a little doubt that mechanistic theories of evolution will prevail completely before long. One effect of the doctrine of evolution has been to compel men to concede to animals some portion, at least, of the merits that they claim for Homo sapiens. Descartes maintained that animals are mere automata. A-U-T-O-M-A-T-A. Automata. Not sure what that word means. If somebody could look it up for me, please. While human beings have free will. Views of this kind have lost their plausibility through the doctrine of emergent evolution, which we shall consider at a later stage, is designed to rehabilitate the view that men differ quantitatively from other animals. Physiology has been the battleground between those who regard all phenomena as subject to scientific method and those who still hope that among vital phenomena there are some, at least. There are some, at least, which demand mystical treatment. Is the human body a mere machine, governed wholly by the principles of physics and chemistry? Wherever it is understood, it is found to be so, and there are still processes which are not completely understood. Perhaps in them a vital principle will be found to be lurking. In this way, the champions of vitalism become the friends of ignorance. Let us not, they feel, know too much about the human body, lest we should discover, to our dismay, that we can understand it. Every fresh discovery makes this view less plausible and restricts territory still open to the obscurationist. There are some, however, who are willing to surrender the body to the tender mercies of the science, of the scientists, provide that they can save the soul. The soul, we know, is immortal and has cognizance of right and wrong. The soul, if it belongs to the right person, is aware of God. It reaches out after higher things and is informed by the divine spark. This being the case, it surely cannot be governed by the laws of physics and chemistry, or indeed by any laws at all. Psychology, therefore, has been more obstinately defended by the enemies of scientific method and any other department of human knowledge. Nevertheless, even psychology is becoming scientific, Many men have contributed to this result, but none more than the Russian psychoiologist. He didn't, or somebody either didn't spell this wrong, or I've never seen this word. P-H-Y-S-I-O-L-O-G-I-S-T. Is that physiologist? Pavlov. Pavlov was born in the year 1849 and devoted the bulk of his working life to the investigation of the behavior of dogs. This, however, is not too wide a statement. The bulk of his work consisted mainly of observing when dogs' mouths water and how much. This illustrates one of the most important characteristics of scientific method, as opposed to the methods of metaphysicians and theologians. The man of science looks for facts that are significant in the sense of leading to general laws, and such facts are frequently quite devoid of intrinsic interest. The first impression of any non-scientific person, when he learns what is being done in some famous laboratory, is that all the investigators are wasting their time on trivialities. But the facts that are intellectually illuminating are often in themselves trivial and uninteresting. Sound level's okay? I haven't even asked. I haven't even bothered looking. I've turned my microphone down some, but still like to know, please. This applies in particular to Pavlov's speciality, namely the flow of saliva in dogs. By studying this, he arrived at general laws governing a great deal of animal behavior and of the behavior of human beings likewise. No clue if the sound levels are okay? Any? The procedure is as follows. Everyone knows that the sight of a juicy morsel will make a dog's mouth water. Pavlov puts a tube into the dog's mouth so that the amount of saliva to which the juicy morsel gives rise can be measured. The flow of saliva when there is food in the mouth is what is called a reflex. That is to say, it is one of those things that the body does spontaneously and without the influence of experience. There are many... I had to say that I started reading this and my mouth started to water. I guess I'm getting a little hungry. There are many reflexes, some very specific, some less so. Some of these can be studied in newborn infants, but some only rise at later. Stages of growth. The infant sneezes and yawns and stretches and sucks and turns its eyes towards a bright light and performs various other bodily movements at the appropriate occasions without the need of any previous learning. All such actions are called reflexes, or in Pavlov's language, unconditioned reflexes. They cover the ground that was formerly covered by somewhat vague appellation of instinct. Complicated instincts, such as nest building in birds, appear to consist of a series of reflexes. In the lower animals, reflexes are very little modified by experience. The moth continues to fly into the flame even after it has singed its wings. But in higher animals, experience has a great effect upon reflexes. And this is most of all cases with man. Pavlov studied the effect of experience upon the salivary reflexes of dogs. The fundamental law in this subject is a law of conditioned reflexes. When the stimulus of an unconditioned reflex has been repeatedly accompanied or immediately preceded by some other stimulus, this other stimulus alone will in time equally produced the response, which was originally called forth by the stimulus of the unconditioned reflex. The flow of saliva is originally called forth only by the action food in the mouth. Later on, it comes to be called forth by the sight and smell, of food, or in any other signal which habitually precedes the giving of food. In this case, we have what is called an unconditional reflex. The response is the same as the unconditional reflex, but the stimulus is a new one, which has become associated with the original stimulus through experience. This law of conditional reflex is the basic of learning of the older psychologists called the association of ideas, of the understanding of language, of habit, and of practicality. Everything in behavior that is due to experience. On the basis of fundamental law, Pavlov has built up experimentally all kinds of complications. He uses not only the stimulus of agreeable food, but also of disagreeable acids, so that he can build up in the dog's responses of avoidance as well as responses of approach. Having formed a conditioned reflex by one set of experiments, he can proceed to inhabit it by another. If a given signal is followed sometimes by pleasant results and sometimes by unpleasant ones, the dog is apt to suffer in the end a nervous breakdown. He becomes hysterical or neurasthenic, and indeed a typical mental patient. Pavlov does not cure him by making him reflect upon his infancy or confess to a guilty passion for his mother, but by rest and bromide. He relates a story which should be studied by all educationists. He had a dog to whom he always showed a circular patch of bright light before giving him food, and an elliptical patch before giving him an electric shock. The dog learned to distinguish clearly between circles and ellipses, rejoicing in the former and avoiding the latter with dismay. Pavlov then gradually diminished the eccentricity of the ellipse, making it more and more nearly resemble a circle. For a long time, the dog continued to distinguish clearly. This is from Pavlov, some of his notes or something. As the form of the ellipse was broken closer and closer to that of the circle, we obtained more or less quickly and increasingly delicate differentiation. But when he used an ellipse whose two axes were as 9 to 8, i.e. an ellipse which was nearly circular, all this was changed. We obtained a new delicate differentiation, which always remained imperfect, lasted 2 or 3 weeks, and afterwards not only disappeared spontaneously, but caused the loss of an earlier differentiation, including even the less delicate ones. The dog, which formerly stood quietly on his bench, now was consistently struggling and howling. It was necessary to elaborate anew all the differentiations, and the most unrefined now demand much more time than at first. On attempting to obtain the final differentiation, the whole story was repeated, i.e. all of differentiations disappeared, And the dog fell again into a state of excitation. I'm afraid a similar procedure is habitual in schools and accounts for the apparent stupidity of many of the scholars. Pavlov is of opinion that sleep is essentially the same thing as inhibition, being in fact a general instead of a specific inhibition. On the basis of his study of dogs, he accepts the views of Hippocrates that there are four temperaments, namely choleric, melancholic, sanguine, and phlegmatic. The phlegmatic and sanguine he regards as the saner types, while the melancholic and choleric are liable to nervous disorders. He finds his dog divisible into these four types and believes the same to be true of human beings. Oh, well. Seems I've come across the first break already. Didn't even know it. That come awful quick. Mark my spot. And take the first break of the show, everyone. Let me see here. Okay, about a 5 minute and 15 second break. Be right back.
Since my childhood days, many of my friends have gone away. Some I never more in this life will see, 'cause time has made a change in me. Time has made a change in the old home place. Time has made a change in a smiling face, and I know my
change in each reach my home in that land somewhere with my friends who wait to meet me over there.
Okay, welcome back, everyone. Heard that song, I like it. I followed the Gaither group on Facebook, and that song was one of the ones that came up today. And I liked it a lot. Yes, it is, Mom. Thanks. The organ through which learning takes place in the cortex, and Pavlov considers himself as being engaged upon the study of the cortex. He is a physiologist, not a psychologist, but he is of opinion that where animals are concerned, there cannot be any psychology, such as we derive from introspection when we study human beings. With human beings, it would seem that he does not go so far as Dr. John B. Watson. Psychology, he says, insofar as it concerns the subjective state of man, has a natural right to existence. For our subjective world, it is the first reality that which we are confronted. But through the right of existence of human psychology be granted, there is no reason that we should not question the necessity of an animal psychology. Where animals are concerned, he is a pure behaviorist, on the ground that one cannot know whether an animal has consciousness, or if it has, of what nature is consciousness may be. In regard to human beings, although, also, in spite of his theoretical concession to introspective psychology, all that he has to say is based upon his study of conditioned reflexes, and it is clear that, in regard to bodily behavior, his position is entirely mechanistic. The following quotation is interesting, not only as illustrating his position on his point, but it's showing the idealistic hopes for the human race which he bases upon the progress of science. I think I'm missing something somewhere. Make sure I just turned to one page. Okay. I did. One can hardly deny that only a study of the physiochemical processes taking place in nerve tissue will give us a real theory of all nervous phenomena, and that the phases of this process will provide us with a full explanation of all external manifestations of nerve activity, their consecutiveness and their interrelations. The following quotation is interesting, not only as illustrating his position on this point, but as showing the idealistic hopes for the human race which he bases upon the process of science. At the beginning of our work, this is Pavlov again, at the beginning of our work, and for a long time afterwards, we felt the compulsion of habit in explaining our subject by psychological interpretations. Every time the objective investigation met an obstacle, or when it was halted by the complexity of the problem, there arose quite naturally misgivings as to the correctness of our new method. Gradually, with the progress of our research, these doubts appeared more rarely, and now I am deeply and irrevocably convinced that along this path will be found the final triumph of the human mind over its uttermost and supreme problem, the knowledge of mechanism and the laws of human nature. Thus only may come a full, true, and permanent happiness. Let the mind rise from victory to victory over surrounding nature. Let it conquer for human life and the activity, not only the surface of the earth, but as all that lies between the depths of the seas and the outer limits of the atmosphere. Let it command for its service prodigious energy to flow from one part of the universe to the other. Let it annihilate space from the transference of its thoughts, yet the same human creature, led by dark powers to wars and revelations and to horrors, produces for itself incalculable material losses and inexpressive pain, and reverses to bestial conditions. Only science, exact science about human nature itself, and the most sincere approach to it by the aid of the omnipotent scientific method, will deliver man from its presence, from its present gloom, and will purge him from contemporary shame into the sphere of interhuman relations. In metaphysics, he is neither a materialist nor a mentalist. He holds the view that I firmly believe to be the right one, on the habit of distinguishing between mind and matter is a mistake, and that the reality may be considered as both or neither with equal justice. We are now coming, he says, to think of the mind, the soul, and the matter of all one, and with this view there will be no necessity for a choice between them. As a human being, Pavlov has the simplicity and regularity of learned men of an earlier time, such as Immanuel Kant. He lived a quiet home life and was invariably punctual at his laboratory. Once during the Revolution, his assistant was 10 minutes late and added the Revolution as an excuse. But Pavlov replied, "What difference does a Revolution make when you have work in the laboratory to do?" The only allusion to the troubles of Russia to be found in his writings was in connection with the difficulty of feeding his animals during the years of food shortage. Although his work has been such as might be held to give support to the official metaphysic of the Communist Party, he thought very ill of the Soviet government, and he denounced it vehemently, both publicly and privately. In spite of this, the government treated him with every consideration, and supplied his laboratory generously with everything that he needed. That's surprising, that's for sure. He must not have known Hillary Clinton.
Oops.
It is typical of the modern attitude in science as compared with that of Newton or even Darwin, that Pavlov has not attempted a statuesque perfection of the presentation of his theories. The reason that I have not given a systematic exposition of our results during the last 20 years is the following. The field is an entirely new one, and the work has constantly advanced. How could I halt for any comprehensive conception to systemize the results? When each day new experiments and observations brought us to additional facts, the rate of progress in science nowadays is much too great for such works as Newton's Principia or Darwin's Origin of Species, because such a book could be completed before such a book can be completed, it would be out of date. In many ways, this is regrettable. For the great books of the past possessed a certain beauty and magnificence which is absent from the fugitive papers of our time. But it is an inevitable consequence of the rapid increase of knowledge and must therefore be accepted philosophically. Whether Pavlov's method can be made to cover the whole of human behavior is open to question. But at any rate, they cover a very large field, and within this field, they have shown how to apply scientific methods with quantitative exactitude. He has conquered a new sphere for exact science, and must therefore be regarded as one of the great men of our time. The problem which Pavlov successfully tackled is that of subjecting to scientific law that has hitherto been called voluntary behavior. Two animals of the same species, or one animal, on two different occasions, may respond differently to the same stimulus. This gave rise to the idea that there is something called a will, which enables us to respond to situations capriciously and without scientific regularity. Pavlov's study is of the conditioned reflex has shown how behavior which is not determined by the congenial constitution of an animal may nevertheless have its own rules and be as capable of scientific treatment as is the behavior governed by unconditioned reflexes. As Professor Hogben says, in our generation, the work of Pavlov's school has successfully tackled, for the first time in history, the problem of what Dr. Haldane calls conscious behavior is non-teleological terms. It has reduced it to the investigation of the conditions under which new reflex systems are brought into being. The more this achievement is studied, the more important it is seen to be, and it is on this account that Pavlov must be placed among the most eminent men of our time. Hogben, The Nature of Living Matter, 1930, page 25. Chapter 2, Characteristics of Scientific Method. Scientific method has been often described, and it is not possible It didn't make sense. I got every scientific method has been often described, and it is not possible at this date to say anything very new about it. Nevertheless, it is necessary to describe it if we are to be in the position later to consider whether any other method of acquiring general knowledge exists. In arrival at a scientific law, there are three main stages. The first consists of observing the significant facts. The second in arriving at a hypothesis, which, if it is true, would account for these facts. The third is deducing from this hypothesis consequences which can be tested by observation. If the consequences are verified, the hypothesis is provisionally accepted as true. Although it will usually require modification later on as the result of the discovery of further facts. In the existing state of science, no facts and no hypothesis are isolated. They exist within the general body of scientific knowledge. The significance of a fact is relative to such knowledge. To say that a fact is significant in science is to say that it helps to establish or refute some general law for science. Though it starts from observation of the particular, it is not concerned essentially with the particular, but with the general. A fact in science is not a mere fact, but an instance. It is the science. It is the scientist differs from the artist, who, if he designs to notice facts as all, is likely to notice them in all their particularity. Science, in its ultimate ideal, consists of a set of propositions arranged in a hierarchy, the lowest level of the hierarchy being concerned with particular facts, and the highest with some general law. Governing everything in the universe, the various levels of the hierarchy have a twofold logical connection, traveling one up, one down. The upward connection proceeds by induction, and the downward by deduction. That is to say, in a perfect science, we should proceed as follows. The particular facts, A, B, C, and D, etc., suggest that probably a certain general law, of which, if it is true, they are all instances. Another set of facts suggest another general law, and so on. All of these general laws suggest, by induction, a law of a higher order of generality of which, if it is true, there are instances. There will be many such stages in passing from particular facts observed to the most general law as yet ascertained. From this general law, we proceed in turn deductively until we arrive at the particular facts from which our previous induction has started. In textbooks, the deductive order will be adopted, but in the laboratory, the inductive order. The only science which has as yet come anywhere near this perfection is physics. The consideration of physics may help us to give concreteness to the above. Abstract account of scientific method. Galileo, as we saw, discovered the law of falling bodies in the neighborhood of the Earth's surface. He discovered that, apart from the resistance of the air, they fell with a constant acceleration, which is the same for all. This was a generalization from a comparatively small number of facts, namely the cases of actual falling bodies, which Galileo had timed. But this generalization was confirmed by his subsequent experiments of the like nature. Galileo's result was a law of the lowest order of generality. As little removed from the crude facts as a general law could be. Meanwhile, Kepler had observed the motions of the planets and the formulation of his three laws as to be orbits. These, again, were laws of the lowest order of generality. Newton collected together Kepler's laws and Galileo's law of falling bodies and the laws of the tides and what was known as to the motions of comets in one law, namely the law of gravitation, which embraced them all. This law, moreover, as usually happens, was a successful generalization. Showed not merely why the previous laws were right, but also why they were not quite right. Bodies near the Earth's surface do not fall with an acceleration which is quite constant. As they approached the Earth, the acceleration is slightly increased. Planets do not move exactly in ellipses. When they approach near to other planets, they are pulled a little out of their orbits. Thus, Newton's law of gravitation superseded the older generalizations, but could scarcely have been arrived at except from them. For over 200 years, no new generalizations were found to swallow up Newton's law of gravitation, as it had swallowed up Kepler's laws. When at least Einstein arrived at such generalization, it placed the law of gravitation in the most unexpected company. To everybody's surprise, it was found to be a law of geometry rather than the advent of physics in the old sense, the proposition with which it has most affinity is the theorem of Pythagoras, to the effect that the squares on the two shorter sides of the right-hand triangle are together equal to the square on the longest side. Every schoolboy terms the proof of this proposition, but only those who read Einstein learn the disproof. To the Greeks and to the moderns, until 100 years ago, geometry was a priori study, like formal logic, not an empirical science based upon observation. Hope I don't butcher this name. Lobachevsky, in the year 1829, demonstrated the falsehood of this opinion, and showed that the truth of Euclidean geometry could only be established by observation, not by reasoning. Although this view gave rise to important new branches of pure mathematics, it did not bear fruit in physics, but in the year 1915, when Einstein embodied it in his general theory of relativity. It now appears that the theorem of Pythagoras is not quite true, and that the exact truth which it adumbrates contains within itself the law of gravitation as an ingredient of consequence. Again, it is not quite Newton's law of gravitation, but a law whose observance consequences are slightly different. Where Einstein differs from Newton in an observable manner, it is found that Einstein is right as against Newton. Einstein's law of gravitation is more general than Newton's, since it applies not only to matter, but also to light and to every form of energy. I think I'll take my break right here. Mark my spot. I definitely need a drink. That's for sure. Let's see. What did I just play? Okay. Here's another new Oak Ridge Boy song from Gaither Group. Be right back in about 4.5 minutes, everyone. Okay, welcome back to the second hour, the final hour, third segment of the show. I got a couple drinks there, and I still got a little scratchiness going on. Einstein's general theory of gravitation demanded as a preliminary, not only Newton's theory, but also the theory of electromagnetism. The science of spectroscopy, observation of high pressure, and the power of minute astronomical observation. Which we owe to large telescopes and the perfecting of the technique of photography. Without all of these preliminaries, Einstein's theory could not have been both discovered and demonstrated. But when the theory is set forth in mathematical form, we start with the generalized law of gravitation and arrive at the end of our argument at those verifiable consequences upon which, in the inductive order, the law was based. In the deductive order, the difficulties of discovery are obscured, and it becomes hard to be aware of the immense extent of the preliminary knowledge required from the induction which led to our major premise. The same sort of development has happened with a rapidity which is truly astonishing in regards to quantum theory. The first discovery that there were facts necessitating such a theory was made in 1900. Yet already the subject can be treated in an utterly abstract way, which scarcely reminds the reader that a universe exists. Throughout the history of physics, from the time of Galileo onward, the importance of these significant facts has been very evident. The facts that are significant at any one stage of the development of a theory are quite different from those that are significant at another stage. When Galileo was establishing the law of falling bodies, the fact that in a vacuum a feather and a lump of lead fall equally fast was more important than the fact that in air a feather falls more slowly, since the first step in understanding falling bodies consisted in realizing that, as far as the Earth's attraction alone is concerned, all falling bodies have the same acceleration. The effect of the resistance of the air must be treated as something superadded to the Earth's attraction. The essential thing is always to look for such facts as illustrate one law in isolation, or at any rate only in combination with laws whose effects are well known. This is why experiment plays such an important part in scientific discovery. In an experiment, the circumstances are artificially simplified so that some one law in isolation may become observable. In most concrete situations, what actually happens requires for its explanation a number of laws in nature, but in order to discover those one by one, it is usually necessary to invent circumstances such that only one of them is relevant. Yeah, he just admits that they're making it up. Right there, he just admitted that they're making it up. Moreover, the most instructive phenomena may be very difficult to observe. Consider, for example, how much our knowledge of matter has been enhanced. By the discovery of X-rays and of radioactivity, yet both of these would have remained unknown but for the most elaborate experimental technique. The discovery of radioactivity was an accident due to the perfecting of photography. Becquerel had some very sensitive photographic plates, which he was meaning to employ. But as the weather was bad, he put them away in the dark cupboard, in which there happened to be some uranium. When they were taken out again, they were found to be photographed. When they were taken out again, they were found to have photographed the uranium, in spite of the complete darkness. It was this accident that led to the discovery of uranium is radioactive. This accidental photographic effort affords another illustration of the significant fact. Outside physics, the part played by deduction is much less, while the part played by observation and by laws immediately based upon observation is much greater. Physics owning to the simplicity of the subject matter has reached a higher stage of development than any other science. I do not think it can be doubted that the ideal is the same for all sciences. But it can be doubted whether humans' capacity will ever be able to make physiology, for example, as perfected a deductive edifice as theoretical physics is now. Even in pure physics, the difficulties of calculation swiftly become insuperable. In the Newtonian gravitation theory, it was impossible to calculate how three bodies would move under their mutual attractions, except approximately when one of them was much bigger than the other two. In the theory of Einstein, which is much more complicated than Newton's, it is impossible to work out with theoretical exactness how two bodies will move under their mutual attraction, though it is possible to obtain a significantly good approximation. For all practical purposes, it is possible to obtain a significantly good approximation for all practical purposes. Fortunately for physics, there are methods of averaging by which the behavior of large bodies can be calculated with a quite significant approximation to the truth, although a wholly exact theory is utterly beyond human powers. Although this may seem a paradox, all exact science is dominated by the ideal of approximation. When a man tells you that he knows the exact truth about anything, you are safe in inferring that he is an inexact man. That reminds me of something I heard many, many years ago. It goes something like, "You show me a man that knows everything, and I'll show you a liar." Pretty much the same thing going on there. Every careful measurement in science is always given with the probable error, which in a technical term conveying a precise meaning. It means that amount of error which is just as likely to be greater than the actual error as to be less. It is characteristic of those matters in which something is known from exceptional accuracy, that in them every observer admits that he is likely to be wrong, and knows about how much wrong he is likely to be. It matters where the truth is not. Ascertainable, no one admits that there is the slightest possibility of even the minutest error in his opinions. And I'm going to go back to read something from the previous page that I'm guessing this is part of let me see here. This is really kind of crazy because he starts something on the one page that is somebody's opinions or something, and then he goes on to something different. The following extract from Nature, February 7, 1931, is typical of the cautious attitude of men of science, wherever carefully measurable is possible. Rotation period of Uranus. The most trustworthy determinations of this period were those made by Professors Lowell and Slipher of at Flagstaff in 1911, and that of Mr. L. Campbell in 1917. The former was spectroscopic. The latter is light variation. The results were periodically identical. 10 hours, 50 meters, and 10 hours, 49 meters, respectively. But there was considered to be room for a further investigation, since the indication probable error of the spectroscopic method was 17 minutes, and the light variation was not confirmed by several other observers. It may, however, be produced by a temporary marketing published ASTSOCPAC for December contains an amount of the new spectroscopic determination made by Messrs. Moore and Menzel. They used a higher dispersion than Lowell and Slipher. Also, the equator of Uranus is more nearly central to the disk. Their weighted mean is 10 hours, 50 meters, with a probable error of 10 meters. But in spite of the close accord with the previous results, they do not consider that a period is certainly known within several minutes. Okay, now I got to go back to the beginning of the page. Whoever heard of theologian prefacing his creed, or a politician concluding his speeches with a statement as to be the probable error in his opinions? It is an odd fact that subjective certainty is inversely proportional to objective certainty. The less reason a man has to suppose himself is the right, the more vehemently he asserts that there is no doubt whatever that he is exactly right. It is a practice of theologians to laugh at science because it changes. Look at us. They say what we assert as the Council of Nicaea will still assert, whereas what the scientists asserted only 2 or 3 years ago is already forgotten and antiquated. Men who speak in this way may have not grasped the great idea of successive approximations. No man who has the scientific temper asserts that what is now believed in science is exactly right. He asserts that it is a stage on the road towards the exact truth. When a change occurs in science, as, for example, from Newton's law of gravitation to Einstein's, what had been done is not overthrown, but is replaced by something slightly more accurate. Suppose you measured yourself with a rough apparatus and came to the conclusion that you were 6 feet tall. You would not suppose, if you were wise, that your height was exactly 6 feet tall, but rather that your height was, say, between 5'11" and 6'1". And if a very careful measurement showed that your height was within a tenth of an inch, 5'11" and 9/10 inches, you would not consider that had overthrown the previous result. The previous result was that your height was about 6 feet. And this remains true. The case with the changes in science is precisely analogous. The part played by measurement and quantity in science is very great, but is, I think, sometimes overestimated. Mathematical technique is powerful, and men of science are naturally anxious to be able to apply it whenever possible. By a law may be quite scientific without being quantitative. Pavlov's laws concerning conditioned reflexes may serve as an illustration. It would probably be impossible to give quantitative precision to these laws. The number of repetitions required to establish conditioned reflexes depends upon many conditions and varies not only with different animals, but with the same animal at different times. In the pursuit of quantitative precision, we should be driven first to the physiology of the cortex and the physical nature of nerve currents, and we should find ourselves unable to stop short of the physics of electrons and protons. There, it is true, quantitative precision may be possible, but to pass back by calculation from pure physics to the phenomena of animal behavior is beyond human power. At any rate, at present, and probably for many ages to come, we must therefore, in dealing with such a matter as animal behavior, be content in the meantime with quantitative laws, which are none the less scientific for not being quantitative. One advantage of quantitative precision, where it is possible, is that it gives much greater strength to inductive arguments. Suppose, for example, that you invent a hypothesis according to which a certain observable quality should have a magnitude, which you work out to 5 significant figures. And suppose that you find an observation that the quantity in question has this magnitude. You will feel that such a coincidence between theory and observation can hardly be an accident, and that your theory must contain at least some important element of truth. Experience shows, however, that it is easy to attach too much importance to such coincidences. Bohr's theory of the atom was originally commended by a remarkable power of calculating theoretically certain quantities which had until then been known only by observation. Nevertheless, Bohr's theory, through a necessary stage in progress, has already been virtually abandoned. The truth is that men cannot frame sufficiently abstract hypotheses. Imagination is always intruding upon logic and causing men to make pictures of occurrences which are essentially incapable of being visualized. In Bohr's theory of the atom, for example, there was a highly abstract constituent. Which was, in all likelihood, true. But this abstract element was embedded in imaginative details, which had no inductive justification. The world that we can picture is the world that we see, but the world of physics is an abstract world that cannot be seen. For this reason, even the hypothesis, which accounts with a minute exactitude for all known relevant facts, must not be regarded as certainly true, since it is probably only some highly abstract aspect of the hypothesis that the logically necessary in the deductions which can't make it to observable phenomena. All scientific laws rest upon induction, which, considered as a logical process, is open to doubt and not capable of giving certainty. There's another admittance right there. That's called theoretical science. Outwardly admitted right there. All scientific laws rest upon induction, which, considered as a logical process, is open to doubt and not capable of giving certainty. Speaking crudely, an inductive argument is of the following kind. If a certain hypothesis is true, then such and such facts will be observable. Now these facts are observable, therefore the hypothesis is probably true. Oh, that sounds like another made-up theory. That almost sounds like a duck has two legs. All ducks have two legs, so everything that has two legs is a duck. That's almost what that sounds like. An argument of this sort will have varying degrees of validity according to circumstances. If we could prove that no other hypothesis was comparable with the observed facts, we could arrive at certainty. But this is hardly ever possible. In general, there will be no method of thinking of all the possible hypotheses, or if there is, it will be found that more than one of them is compatible with the facts. When this is the case, the scientist adopts the simplest of the working hypotheses, and only reverts to more complicated hypotheses if new facts show that the simplest hypothesis is inadequate. If you have ever seen a cat without a tail, the simplest hypothesis is to account for this fact would be all cats have tails. But the first time that you saw a Manx cat, you would be compelled to adopt a more complicated hypothesis. The man who argues that because all cats have been seen have tails, therefore all cats have tails, is employed that is called induction by simple enumeration. This is a very dangerous form of argument. In this better forms, induction is based upon the fact that our hypothesis leads to consequences which are found to be true, but which, if they had not been observed, would seem extremely improbable. If you meet a man who has a pair of dice that always throw double sixes, it is possible that he is lucky, but there is another hypothesis which would make the observed facts less astonishing. You will therefore be well advised to adopt his other hypothesis. In all good inductions, the facts accounted for by the hypothesis are such as would be. Antecedently improbable. The more improbable they would be, the greater becomes the improbability of the hypothesis which accounts for them. Okay, I'm going to mark my spot right there. Take the last break for the show, everyone. I didn't think this would be as highly of a scientific book as what it is, that's for sure. I probably would have picked something else if it had been. Let's see here. I recorded a third song, but I'm trying to find it now. It was another Oak Ridge Boys song. And I'm having a little trouble finding it right now. Oh, I didn't get the... where's the other ones? Okay. I played that song already. Okay, I think this is the new one. About 3 3/4 minutes, everyone. I'll be right back.
Tonight we're actually very grateful to be joined by the one and only Mr. T. Mr. T, if you could just say hello.
Sorry, that wasn't it. I'll have to pick something else. I think this is it. I think. Be right back in 5 minutes, 15 seconds, everyone.
Since my childhood days, many of my friends have gone away. Some I never more in this life will see, 'cause time has made a change in me. Time has made a change in the old home place. Time has made a change in a smiling face. And I know my friends can plainly see. Time has made a change in me. In my childhood days, I was well. makes my home in that land somewhere with my friends who wait to meet me over there.
Okay, sorry about that little interruption there at the beginning of the break. I put a song in there, and it wasn't in my library, so it chose something else. It wasn't anywhere near. Kind of have to figure that out sometime. Not right now, though. Hang on a second here. All right, sorry about that. This, as we remarked a moment ago, is one of the advantages of measurement. If something which might have any size is found to have just the size that your hypothesis has led you to expect, you feel that your hypothesis must at least have something in it. As common sense, this seems evident, but as logic, it has certain difficulties. This, however, we will not consider until the next chapter. There is one remaining characteristic of scientific method about which something must be said, namely analysis. It is generally assumed by men of science, at any rate, as a working hypothesis, that any concrete occurrence is a result of a number of causes, each of which, acting separately, might produce some different result from that which actually occurs, and that the resultant can be calculated when the effects of the separate causes are known. The simplest examples of this occur in mechanics. The moon is attracted both by the earth and by the sun. If the earth acted alone, the moon would describe one orbit. If the sun acted alone, it would describe another. But its actual orbit is calculable when we know the effects which the earth and the sun separately would produce. When we know how bodies fall in a vacuum, and also the law of the resistance of the air, we can calculate how bodies will fall in air. The principle that cause laws can, in this way, be separated by, and then recombined, is in some degree essential to the procedure of science, for it is impossible to take account of everything at once, or to arrive at casual laws unless we isolate them at one time. It must be said, however, that there is no reason a priori to suppose that the effect of two causes acting simultaneously will be calculable from the effects which they have severally. And in the most modern physics, this principle is found to have less truth than was formerly supposed. It remains a practical and approximate principle in suitable circumstances, but it cannot be laid down as a general property of the universe. Undoubtedly, where it fails, science becomes very difficult. But so far as we can see, as can be seen at present, it retains sufficient truth to be employed as a hypothesis, except in the most advanced and delicate calculations. Chapter 3, Limitations of Scientific Method. Just define my mouse here for a second. Okay. Whatever knowledge we possess is either knowledge of particular facts or scientific knowledge. The details of history and geography lie outside science in a sense. That is to say, they are presupposed by science and form the basis upon which it is a superstructure. The sort of things that are demanded on a passport, such as a name, date of birth, color of grandfather's eyes, etc., are brute facts. The past existence of Caesar and Napoleon, the present existence of the earth and the sun and the other heavenly bodies may also be regarded as brute facts. That is to say, most of us accept them as such, but strictly speaking, they involved influences which may or may not be correct. If a boy learning history were to refuse to believe in the existence of Napoleon, he would probably be punished, which might for a pragmatist constitute sufficient proof that there was such a man. If the boy were not a pragmatist, he might reflect that if his teacher had any reason to believe it, Napoleon, the reason might have been disclosed. Very few teachers of history, I believe, would be able to produce any poor argument to show that Napoleon was not a myth. I am not saying that such arguments do not exist. I am only saying that most people do not. Know what they are. Clearly, if you are going to believe anything outside your own experience, you should have some reason for believing it. Usually the reason is authority. When it was first proposed to establish laboratories at Cambridge, Todd Hunter, the mathematician, objected that it was unnecessary for students to see experiments performed, since the results could be vouched for by their teachers. All of them men of the highest character, and many of them clergymen of the Church of England. Todd Hunter considered that the argument from authority should suffice, but we all know how often authority has been proven mistaken. It is true that most of us must inevitably depend upon it for most of our knowledge. I accept on authority the existence of Cape Horn, and it is clearly impossible that each of us should verify all the facts of geography. But it is important that the opportunity for verification should exist, and that its occasional necessity should be recognized. To revert to history as we proceed into the past, there is a gradually increasing doubt. Did Pythagoras exist? Probably. Did Romulus exist? Probably not. Did Remus exist? Almost certainly not. But the difference between the evidence for Napoleon and the evidence for Romulus is only one of degree. Strictly speaking, neither the one nor the other can be accepted as merely fact or fict, or as mere matter of fact, since neither comes within our distinct experience. Does the sun exist? Question mark. Most people would say that the sun does come within our direct experience in a sense in which Napoleon does not, but in thinking this, they would be mistaken. The sun is removed from us in space as Napoleon is removed from us in time. The sun, like Napoleon, is known to us only through its effects. People say they see the sun, but that only means that something has traveled through the intervening 93 million miles and produced an effect upon the retina, the optic nerve, and the brain. This effect, which happens where we are, is certainly not identical with the sun as understood by astronomers. Indeed, the same effect might be produced by another means. In theory, a hot globe of molten metal can be hung up in such a position that, to a given observer, it would seem just like the sun. The effect upon the observer might be made indistinguishable from the effect which the sun produces. The sun, therefore, is an inference from what we see, and is not the actual path of brightness of which we aren't immediately aware. It is characteristic of the advance of science that less and less is found to be datum, and more is found to be inference. The inference is, of course, quite unconscious, except in those who have trained themselves in philosophical skepticism. But it must not be supposed that an unconscious inference is necessarily valid. Babies think that there is another baby on the other side of the looking glass, and although they have not arrived at their own conclusion, biological process, it is nevertheless mistaken. Many of our unconscious inferences, which are fact-conditioned reflexes acquired in early infancy and highly dubious as soon as they are subjected to logical scrutiny. Physics has been compelled by its own necessities to take account of some of these unwarrantable prejudices. The plain man thinks that matter is solid, but the physicist thinks that it is a wave of probability undulating in nothingness. To put it briefly, the matter in a place is defined as the likelihood of our seeing a ghost there. For the moment, however, I am not yet concerned with these metaphysical speculations, but with the features of scientific method which have given rise to them. The limitations of scientific method have become much more evident in recent years than they ever were before. They have become more evident in physics, which is the most advanced of the sciences. And so far, these limitations have had little effect upon the other sciences. Nevertheless, since it is the theoretical goal of every science to be absorbed in physics, we are not likely to go astray if we apply to science in general the doubts and difficulties which had become obvious in the sphere of physics. The limitations of scientific method may be collected under three heads. Number one, the doubt as to the validity of induction. Number two, the difficulty of drawing inferences from what is experienced to what is not experienced. And number three, even allowing that there can be inference to what is not experienced, the fact that each inference must be of an extremely abstract character and gives therefore less information than it appears to do when ordinary language is employed. Number one, induction. All inductive arguments are in the last resort reduce themselves into the following form. If this is true, that is true. Now that is true, therefore this is true. That's not a valid argument. This argument is, of course, formally fallacious. Exactly. That's not a valid argument. Suppose I were to say, if bread is a stone and stones are nourished, then this bread will nourish me. Now this bread does not nourish me. Therefore, it is a stone, and stones are nourishing. If I were to advance such an argument, I should certainly be thought foolish. Yet it would not be fundamentally different from the arguments upon which all scientific laws are based. There's another admission right there. In science, we always argue that since the observed facts obey certain laws, therefore other facts in the same region will obey the same laws. We may verify these subsequently over a greater or smaller region, but its practical importance is always in regard to those regions where it has not yet been verified. We have verified the laws of statics. For example, in countless cases, we employ them in building a bridge. In regard to the bridge, they are not verified until we find that the bridge stays up. But this importance lies in enabling us to predict beforehand that the bridge will stay up. It is easy to see why we think it will. This is merely an example of Pavlov's conditioned reflexes, which cause us to expect whatever combinations we have frequently experienced in the past. But if you have to cross a bridge in a train, it is no comfort to you to know why the engineer thought it was a good bridge. The important thing is that it should be a good bridge. And this requires that his induction from the laws of statics in observed cases to the same laws in observed cases should be a valid one. Now, fortunately, no one has hitherto shown any good reason for supposing that this sort of inference is sound. Hume, nearly 200 years ago, threw doubt upon induction, as indeed upon most other things. The philosophers were indignant and invented refutations of Hume, which passed muster on account to their extreme obscurity. Indeed, for a long time, philosophers took care to be unintelligible, since otherwise everybody would have perceived that they had been successful in answering Hume. It is easy to invent a metaphysic which will have as a consequence that induction is valid. And many men have done so, but they have not shown any reason to believe in their metaphysics, except that it was pleasant. The metaphysic of Bergson, for example, is undoubtedly pleasant. Like cocktails, it enables us to see the world as a unity without sharp distinctions. And for all its vaguely agreeable, but it has no better claim than cocktails have to be included into the technique of the pursuit of knowledge. There may be valid grounds for believing in induction, and in fact, none of us can help believing in it. But it must be admitted that In theory, induction remains an unsolved problem of logic, as this doubt, however, affects practically the whole of our knowledge. We may pass it by and assume pragmatically that induction procedures with proper safeguards is admissible. Let me see here. I guess I'll start number two. Just go through, start a little bit, and I can start it next Tuesday. Start over, maybe. Inferences to what is not experienced. As we observe above, what is actually experienced is much less than one would naturally suppose. You may say, for example, that you see your friend, Mr. Jones, walking along the street, but this is to go far beyond what you have any right to say. You see a succession of colored patches traversing a stationary background. These patches, by means of a Pavlov conditioned reflex, bring into your mind the word Jones. And so you see Jones, but other people looking out of their windows from different angles will see something different. Owing to the laws of perspective. Therefore, if they are all seeing Jones, there must be as many different Joneses as there are speculators. And if there is only one true Jones, the sight of him is not vouchsafed to anybody. Yeah, little... If we assume for a moment the truth of the account which physics gives, we shall explain what you call seeing Jones in some such terms as the following. Little packets of light called light quanta shoot out from the sun, and some of these reach a region where there are atoms of a certain kind, composing Jones's face and hands and clothes. These atoms do not themselves exist, but they are merely a compendious way of alluding to possible occurrences. Some of the light quanta, when they reach Jones's atoms, upset their internal economy. I will stop right there for the day. I guess it's nighttime for some people somewhere. So thanks everyone for coming out. No song at the end. I'm just going to drop the radio streams. See everyone tomorrow, hopefully, for Roger and me.